Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's first page, our first headline reads, Linn County Access Center sees needs growing. Work underway to expand to 24/7, an open hub for youth, by Gage Miskeman. It's been a year and a half since Linn County opened its Mental Health Access Center, and the demand for mental health services in the county still is increasing. The need is so great that the center may expand its hours to 24/7, and a youth assessment center is being discussed. The Access Center opened in March 2021. In its first fiscal year, July 1, 2021 through June 30, 2022, it saw 785 walk-in patients. Currently, the center is open for walk-in hours 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Access Center Director Aaron Foster still is working on making the center available for walk-ins 24/7, but so far that has been a challenge. Working through opening the center was a feat, and we have it up and running, minus the workforce issues that affected us like everyone else, Foster said. I wish we were open 24/7, but that's 100% connected to the workforce shortage. But we know, based on what we've seen the last year and a half, that these services are very needed. Linn County supervisors provided $3.5 million in startup funding for the center, which is located in the building that formerly housed Linn County Public Health at 501 13th Street Northwest, Cedar Rapids. Services include crisis triage and counseling, mental health evaluations and prescriber appointments, peer support, crisis stabilization, and a sobering unit. Services are provided by Abbey Health, Area Ambulance Service, Foundation 2, and St. Luke's Chemical Dependency. Since the center receives funding from the East Central Mental Health Region, it is open to individuals from 9 counties, Benton, Bremer, Buchanan, Delaware, Dubuque, Iowa, Johnson, Jones, and Linn. The county's property taxes help fund the Access Center. So far this year, the numbers are on track to surpass the first year. In the first 3 months of this fiscal year, 310 walk-ins have come through the center's doors. Last year, law enforcement referrals totaled 124. In fiscal 2023, so far, that number is at 56. A key part of the center is that it provides law enforcement a place other than jail or a hospital emergency room to take people who are experiencing a crisis. I'm really happy about our jail and hospital diversion rates, Foster said. According to our surveys, 41% of our law enforcement referrals would have gone to jail if we didn't have the center, and 36% would have been taken to the hospital. Foster added that outpatient surveys show that 35% of patients would have taken themselves to the ER or called 911 if there wasn't an access center. That is a huge success for us, she said. Foster said she thinks the increase of patients is a combination of variables, from the center's community outreach to its partnerships with nonprofits like Waypoint and Simply More Need in hard times. It's been a difficult 3 years, Foster said. A lot of people have experienced loss and have now been looking at mental health from a personal standpoint. With COVID, the derecho, and other world events, we know people's mental health has been affected, and that's on the increase. Another question the center's outpatient survey asks, if the Access Center didn't exist, what would you have done instead? 28% of respondents said that they would have done nothing. Around 1 in 5 adults in the U.S. experience mental illness, according to Mental Health America. In Iowa, that percentage is similar to the national trend, which is equal to 441,000 Iowans with a diagnosable mental behavior or emotional disorder. Moving forward for the Access Center, Foster said she would like to see the center offer its withdrawal management program in summer 2023. She also added that she is hopeful that the walk-in hours will be 24/7 in early 2023. We're close to making more hires, Foster said. We have amazing staff here, and we're not just looking for seat fillers. That can't happen here. The staff here truly have the core components of empathy and compassion, being able to think outside of the box and on their feet. Rogers said the other challenge for the center is that in Iowa, funding for mental health services and substance use are separated. For an access center, providers are able to bill Medicaid for mental health services, but we have to use local property tax dollars to fund the substance use portion, Supervisor Ben Rogers said. We're one of the few states that don't allow those fundings to be woven. It really handcuffs us. Added Foster, something has to come along statewide with funding and reimbursement rates. To not view these services as specialty-type services is wrong, and it's not doing anyone any justice. Rogers and Foster also are involved in the very early planning phases, for a future youth assessment center which would provide mental health services to children and families. The Mental Health Access Center only provides services to adults. It would help youth and families in crisis access timely services, Rogers said. It will help them to navigate the system. That's what we're working on now because children hopefully become adults someday, and trying to address these issues early on in their life is statistically a lot better odds than helping them when they're older. Also on today's front page, research making it safer to clear roads in a blizzard. ISU research could help snowplow drivers see better. By Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. New research and technology could help guide Iowa snowplow drivers during whiteout conditions and alert them to obstacles, improving driver safety and keeping roads open in low visibility conditions. The Iowa Department of Transportation is working with Iowa State University's Institute for Transportation to develop a system that allows its workers to see better in bad weather. It entails equipping snowplows with sensors and driver aids to allow staff to continue working in whiteout conditions that improves the safety of both those traveling on the roads and drivers, said Tina Greenfield, road weather information coordinator with the Iowa DOT's Maintenance Bureau. The plowing situation is challenging even in normal conditions, Greenfield said. There's a lot of snow that is cast up by the front plow as it's plowing. Drivers live in a constant snow cloud just because of the nature of their job. And then when it gets really bad out, when the wind is howling and the snow is blowing, it's hard to see where the road is. If they can't see where they're going, they really can't be out there and plowing. When we pull off, that's when the roads really start to clog up. Once the plows have to pull off, the drifts start building. For the past year, ISU researchers have been investigating potential navigation equipment, taking lessons and cues from similar lane departure and obstacle detection systems used by state transportation departments in Alaska and Minnesota. In late September, ISU researchers and a group of 20 snowplow drivers from around the state gathered in Ames to look at options and provide feedback, including which navigation and obstacle alerts and user interface would be most useful. And earlier this month, researchers traveled to the Iowa DOT's Tama shop to install the first iteration of the equipment on a snowplow for testing. Sensors mounted to the plow will feed information to equipment in the cab that processes it and displays the data on a tablet screen mounted on the dash. Anuj Sharma, ISU professor in civil engineering and a research scientist at its Institute for Transportation, said that the system is being tested builds off those being used in autonomous vehicles now in development. Greenfield, though, stressed the equipment being tested will not automate any of the functions of the snowplow. The driver is still in charge of the snow truck, she said. Instead, the equipment will function similar to a blind spot alert or lane departure system one might have in their car. It uses a combination of sensors, radar, and LiDAR 3D scanning for collision avoidance and advanced GPS technology for navigation and lane management. Most modern cars today have lane departure sensing that relies on cameras, Sharma said. But most of the time, the road is covered with snow, and so you can't rely on cameras that can detect lane markings. Instead, the system relies on a database of high-definition mapping and high-accuracy GPS technology to determine where a plow is in terms of position in the lane and a display to show the truck's position on the roadway and proximity to obstacles such as a car, bridge piers and abutments, and guardrails that may be covered by snowdrifts. Obstacle detection relies on the use of LiDAR, a remote sensing technology that uses the pulse from a laser to collect measurements to create 3D models and maps of objects and environments. Alaska State Department of Transportation uses similar technology. Snowplows are outfitted with a differential GPS guidance system that uses information from ground stations, satellites, and GPS receivers mounted atop the cab to pinpoint the vehicle's location with an accuracy of 3 to 5 centimeters. In the cab, drivers have a display that shows the truck's position relative to the lane markings on a moving map. If the truck travels over the lane marking, a solid red line appears, warning the driver it has crossed out of the prescribed lane. With the unpredictability of an Iowa winter, that would help keep trucks on the road in low visibility conditions, the Iowa DOT's Greenfield said. That means potentially fewer motorists stranded in deep or blowing snow, better access for emergency vehicles, keeping roads from becoming completely impassable, and quicker cleanup to get roads back to normal following a storm. UI builds trust with Spanish-speaking patients. Course is to establish and cultivate a trusting provider-patient relationship. By Vanessa Miller. Speaking a different language in a healthcare setting can not only prevent patients from communicating aches and pains or doctors from relaying important medical news or instructions, it can keep people from seeking care altogether. Jessica Ortiz has seen it firsthand with her Ecuadorian parents who don't speak fluent English. Sometimes here they feel like, oh no, I don't feel comfortable, maybe they don't understand what I'm saying, Ortiz of Coralville said, noting even scheduling an appointment can become an insurmountable challenge, so they need help. Fortunately, her parents can get that help from their daughter, who has a medical degree and speaks English fluently. Like last year when her mom twisted her ankle and had to seek emergency care. I had to be there the whole time, she said, to translate what the provider was saying. But because children so often play the translator for non-fluent parents, the message doesn't always get across. Sometimes the parents feel embarrassed to say something really private to the kid that the kid has to say to the provider, Ortiz said. That can have meaningful implications and limitations, but something as simple as an hola or como estás from a physician can change everything, according to Ortiz. They relax more, she said. They feel more like, okay, I can do this by myself, or the doctor really is going to take care of me. Having volunteered for many of her 16 years in the United States, sharing her language and culture with her daughter's elementary school and with the Iowa City Johnson County Senior Center, for example, Ortiz saw a need she could help meet in the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. So she designed a Spanish course for medical faculty with some Spanish-speaking ability already, similar to one she teaches at the Senior Center, but catered specifically to those needing to communicate and comprehend medical information. It doesn't teach grammar, syntax, or general vocabulary. It's very specifically designed for a healthcare provider with an intermediate to advanced Spanish level, so we can focus just on teaching medical Spanish terminology, she said. The topics are very specific. The university in fall 2021 offered for the first time free medical Spanish course for faculty with an intermediate to advanced level of Spanish, focused on teaching medical Spanish terminology, pronunciation, and cultural practices and health beliefs unique to the Latinx and Hispanic community. So we try to improve their cultural competence, she said. Among its goals, the course aims to give providers confidence in obtaining a basic medical history from Spanish-speaking patients and performing a full physical exam. Other course objectives include teaching physicians Spanish medical terminology, how to translate basic anatomic terms to and from English, and ways to improve conversational skills during a medical interview with Spanish-speaking patients. Tips to make holiday more about drumsticks than debate, by Vanessa Miller. The adage of never talking religion or politics with family and friends, especially over dinner or the holidays, is getting harder to follow these days, given that those off-limits subjects increasingly are bleeding into topics typically deemed safer, like the cost of the turkey, the weather, or even Taylor Swift. While family arriving to a holiday gathering a decade ago might have come with a clean slate, many today come fired up and ready to pounce over comments made and seen on one social media giant or another, platforms that themselves have become the subject of political discord. But a path to holiday harmony exists, according to University of Iowa Management and Entrepreneurship Professor Michelle Williams, who for more than 5 years has taught courses on inclusive leadership and negotiations in the UI Tippey College of Business. The dispute resolution, conflict resolution, and negotiation tactics are actually things that we can apply to everyday life to make our gatherings more positive, Williams said. Among potentially fraught topics at this season's holiday gatherings, above and beyond the religion and politics landmines, are gas prices, grocery bills, Twitter, worker conditions, the World Cup, even concert ticket sales. The breadth of looming conflict zones today is so wide, Williams said, just avoiding them might be impossible. So I think that when conversations come up, if people can handle them as a dialogue, so an exploration of joining a shared understanding, Williams said, that orientation to the conversation may allow it to take a more positive bent, where people come to a greater understanding and appreciation of each other. Of course, keeping emotions at bay during heated discussions on hot topics is easier said than done, which is why Williams suggests three techniques for achieving dialogue rather than debate. First, she said, listen with intention to understand. Americans tend not to listen, or they listen just enough to answer, say what they want to say, or prove the other side wrong, she said. And that's a debate tactic. Try instead something called generative listening, Williams said, seeking to understand someone through the most generous and positive light, assuming their best intentions. So that's number one, listening with empathy and grace in a generative way. Her second tip is to slow down. A lot of times our conversations get away from us, she said, highlighting how quickly a discussion can escalate into a debate or even argument. We are so quick to respond. Instead, Williams suggested using a University of Michigan-developed listening technique called the Lara Method, which stands for listening, affirming, responding, and then adding any additional insights, information, or questions to the conversation. The affirming piece is important in that it challenges the listener to repeat back what they've heard before responding with their thoughts, and it ensures the speaker has been understood, according to Williams. That slows down the conversation to make sure people feel heard, she said. The third technique is to stay curious. When people say something that might trigger you, ask a question, Williams said. How did you come to that conclusion? Sometimes you can uncover assumptions either that you're making or that they're making, which makes you able to at least agree to disagree rather than jumping down each other's throats. Now moving to some articles from inside the paper. 500 Holiday Meals Given Out in CR by Emily Anderson. Together We Achieve, a Cedar Rapids-based nonprofit, handed out Thanksgiving dinners to 500 households Monday. Families pre-registered to receive the meals, which included a turkey, a bag of potatoes, cranberry sauce, rolls, green beans, mac and cheese, stuffing, taco mac, creamed corn, tomatoes, raisins, walnuts, and spices for cooking, according to Raymond Siddell, the founder and president of Together We Achieve. This is our third year in a row that we've done this, Siddell said. In 2020 and 2021, we did 350 families for Thanksgiving each year, and we did 350 families for Christmas as well. This year, we were able to increase it to 500 for both. The registration for the Family Feast Fund giveaway, which is the meal Together We Achieve gives out in December, still is open. The nonprofit also is searching for volunteers and accepting donations for that giveaway. Families and volunteers can register on the nonprofit's website. We call it Family Feast Fun for the Holidays rather than Christmas in case people don't celebrate, Siddell said. Supreme Beef Feedlot Will Have Less State Supervision by Aaron Jordan. An 11,600-head cattle feedlot, the focus of an ongoing lawsuit against the state and continued scrutiny from neighbors, soon will have less state oversight because owners have satisfied a stormwater permit that will expire January 1st. Owners of Supreme Beef near Monona in the Bloody Run Creek watershed recently finished repairs and landscaping required to close out the federal permit issued in 2018. Now that the construction activities are completed, they are doing final stabilization, said Shane Dodge, supervisor of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Manchester office. They've been working on that for months and months and months. Once that permit expires, Supreme Beef will have a full inspection once every 5 years, per the state standard for large animal feedlots, said Brian Jurgensen, environmental specialist senior in the DNR's Manchester office. However, Jurgensen expects state officials will be out at the site once or twice a year, and they won't be the only ones watching Supreme Beef, which has raised concerns of neighbors since 2017. The feedlot is built on porous karst terrain, and opponents fear any manure leaks will quickly seep into groundwater or Bloody Run. They are definitely in a fishbowl, Dodge said. They understand that. The feedlot had so many violations of stormwater discharge rules in 2018, the DNR proposed shifting the case to the Iowa Attorney General's office, which could seek higher penalties. The Iowa Environmental Protection Commission rejected that idea. The Iowa DNR issued Supreme Beef a notice of violation last spring for failure to maintain stormwater controls, resulting in sediment washing into nearby tile lines, according to records obtained by the Gazette through an open records request. Since then, Supreme Beef has installed a fence to keep silt from going into tile lines, shored up a gully, seeded flat areas, and installed a sloped concrete pad to keep manure from washing off-site. The Iowa chapters of the Sierra Club and Trout Unlimited are suing the DNR over the April 2021 approval of Supreme Beef's nutrient management plan. A hearing is set for January 20th in Polk County. There have been several complaints against Supreme Beef in the last year, records show. On December 9, 2021, Steve Vasey and Larry Stone, water quality advocates, collected water samples from the tile lines near Supreme Beef and had the water tested at the State Hygienic Lab. The samples contained E. coli bacteria and ammonia, the complaint stated. Vasey and Stone alleged Supreme Beef had discharged pollutants into a public waterway without having a discharge permit. The Iowa DNR said the agency does not take enforcement actions based on third-party results. The complainants also said Supreme Beef and the nearby W6 farm should be counted as one operation, since members of the Waltz family own both farms. The DNR has determined that they are two separate facilities, Jurgensen wrote December 30th. Documentation provided by the facilities indicated that no one member owns a majority interest in either company. Stone asked in March whether an earthen manure lagoon at the site was legal. The Iowa DNR responded the lagoon was allowed since Supreme Beef would not be seeking a federal discharge permit after the construction phase. In June, someone called the Manchester office to complain about a manure smell. Complainant states manure odor on Main Street in town has been bad when wind is blowing from south or southeast in combination with rain events and believes the odor is originating from Supreme Beef, records state. Supreme Beef started loading cattle into the feedlot in December and had about 8,000 head in August, Jurgensen said. He forwarded the complaint to owner Jared Waltz June 20th. The person calling knew that the concerns would not be enforceable by our office, but wanted me to pass the comments along to you. Dodge said Waltz has worked hard in recent months to comply with Iowa DNR requests. He understands the sensitivity around that facility, particularly in that location, Dodge said. They've invested a tremendous amount of resources to keep that manure on site. There are a lot of folks helping us keep an eye on that facility. Waltz did not immediately return an email requesting comment for this article. Iowa jury awards $27 million in meningitis misdiagnosis by David Pitt of the Associated Press, Des Moines. An Iowa jury has returned a $27 million verdict against a Des Moines medical clinic after a man with bacterial meningitis was misdiagnosed with the flu, suffered strokes, and said he has been permanently injured. The Polk County jury returned the verdict Monday in the lawsuit filed in 2017 against Unity Point Clinic Family Medicine in Des Moines. Joseph Dudley and his wife Sarah Dudley filed the lawsuit after Joseph became ill in February 2017 and went to the clinic in southeast Des Moines. They reported he had dizziness, delusions, a headache, high fever, and a cough. A physician assistant in charge of the clinic at the time diagnosed him with the flu, although tests returned negative, according to Dudley's lawyer, Nick Rowley. Dudley was given Tamiflu and a pain reliever and sent home. 2 days later, he went to the emergency room at Unity Point Iowa Methodist Medical Center, where a doctor diagnosed the bacterial meningitis resulting from a heart valve infection. Dudley was put in a medically induced coma and was in intensive care for 8 days, during which he had a series of strokes, causing the loss of hearing in his right ear, vertigo and dizziness, numb feet and legs, and much slower thinking and reaction time, Rowley said. Mr. Dudley will suffer from a lifetime of permanent brain damage because they failed to perform a simple blood test, a complete blood count, said Rowley, founder of Trial Lawyers for Justice. West Des Moines-based Unity Point Health has 400 clinics, 20 regional hospitals, and 19 community network hospitals in Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. Unity Point Health spokesman Mark Tauschek said the company believes it met well-established standards of care. We respect the jury process, but strongly disagree with this verdict and are exploring all options, including an appeal, he said. Iowa students provide water in Kenya. By Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times, Davenport. Though an impactful player in Davenport West High School's storybook 2022 football season, senior Duro Johnson also aims to make an impact overseas. Johnson and three of his peers will travel to the eastern Kenya village of Muamba in January to implement a student-designed water filtration system, which will affect roughly 22,000 people. My family is from Africa, so it interested me, Johnson said, adding that he has grandparents and cousins currently living in Nigeria. Through an ongoing partnership with Fishers of Men Ministries, West students taking the Engineering Design and Development capstone class have worked on the project for roughly 6 years. Fishers of Men is an international nonprofit Christian ministry organization based in Davenport that works to provide water wells, churches, schools, and homes for children and families in Kenya. We're blessed to have this partnership, founder Joshua Ngao said. We have 19 water wells in Kenya, but we have thousands of people who are dying right now because there's no water or because of water contamination. Growing up in Kenya, Ngao said he walked almost 50 miles for drinking water, something many take for granted. If you ask people here where their drinking water comes from, many don't know. Everyone in Kenya knows exactly where their water comes from, he said. I think when students come here, they're going to start to approach life with a lot of thankfulness. They're going to see those needs, but also find themselves meeting those needs by giving people water. After brainstorming a few project ideas, students chose to embark on designing, building, and implementing a water filtration system to be placed in villages throughout Kenya. The plan was to implement it within a year or two, but we fell a little behind schedule in 2020. I took a student to Kenya to get data, then COVID happened and slowed the process since then, said Greg Smith, who teaches the course and will accompany the students to Kenya. Students finished the fully functioning water filtration system last year, though Smith said the one built in Kenya will be roughly 5 times the size of the school's model. Johnson, who also helped in the construction phase, led the design of a building to house the system. Number one, to protect the system, but the biggest thing, using natural materials so they don't have to get things from outside their country, Smith said. We can get rock, sand, and gravel pretty much anywhere in the world, so it lends itself naturally to what we're doing. The only thing that's not natural are the piping and storage containers, but that stuff is readily available and we can adapt. We gave Duro some design parameters, he came up with the data, and then Joshua would come and give feedback. Adaptation was part of the learning experience for Johnson and his small team's design process. Some of these places don't have the type of technology and resources that we do here, so we had to consider those needs and work around them, he said. The building's construction began in late September. When we sent the plan to Kenya, I explained it to the people in Swahili so they were able to understand what the students came up with, Nagao said. So it's almost like we're building together in everything we're doing. Johnson said he was surprised but excited that the group's design was chosen. I just want that real-life experience, actually going over there to build something that will help people throughout their communities, he said. Though they'll first begin implementing systems in eastern Kenya, Nagao doesn't intend to stop there. We're starting there because it goes a long time without raining, so that's where we've done more work with deep water wells, he said. But the goal is to implement the system in all 42 counties in Kenya. Alternative fuel production coming to Fairfax. 11 of 23 new jobs qualify for state high-quality program. By Sarah Conrad Baranowski. A Wisconsin-based company that produces pellets for renewable fuel will receive incentives from the state of Iowa to create jobs at its new location in Fairfax. The Iowa Economic Development Authority said last week it has awarded incentives to Convergent Energy. The company plans to establish a 100,000-square-foot production facility in Fairfax to better position the company to reach new and existing customers throughout the region, according to an IEDA news release. 11 of the 23 new jobs that Convergent will create in Iowa will qualify for the state's high-quality jobs program at a qualifying wage of $24.20 per hour. Convergent will have a capital investment of $18.4 million. The company, founded in 2009, produces pellets that are used in solid fuel power and steam generation facilities. The process shreds and blends non-recyclable paper, labels, and packaging material destined for landfills, and turns them into pellets that can be used in solid fuel boilers such as those that burn coal. Convergent has been working with the University of Iowa for years to turn university-grown miscanthus grass into pellets that can be burned at the UI power plant. The Fairfax City Council earlier this month voted to approve a resolution that expresses its intent to provide economic development support to Convergent Energy. According to the resolution, the city will provide tax exemptions on a sliding scale from 75% in year one to 15% in year five. Fairfax City Clerk Treasurer Cynthia Stimson said the city plans to annex land along Lefebure Road, south of Trevera Logistics, where the Convergent plant will be built. A University of Iowa spinoff company that's developing treatments for knee injuries received a demonstration fund award from the IEDA board last week. Cartilagen was awarded $125,000 for product refinement, marketing, planning, market entry activities, and key personnel. The company was founded by Frank Yu, a former UI graduate student, and Jason Marks, a former UI undergraduate student, who developed the treatment while working together in a university research lab. The company produces an intra-articular injection of small molecule drug that can prevent osteoarthritis after a traumatic injury. Online Iowa history resources catching on. State Historical Society collection tops 3 million views. Iowa educators are using a new tool to teach Iowa history, and it's catching on in classrooms across the state as well as with families. A special online collection of history education materials has been viewed more than 3 million times since the State Historical Society of Iowa started curating it 5 years ago. It surpassed that mark in the middle of October, designated as National Arts and Humanities Month. The primary source sets, photos, maps, documents, audio recordings, and even cartoons cover more than 65 broad topics about Iowa and its role in the broader sweep of national and world history, including the Underground Railroad, women's suffrage, the Cold War, and the Iowa caucuses. We want to empower teachers, students, and families across the state to learn more about Iowa history and are providing them with a variety of resources to archive this, State Historical Society of Iowa Administrator Susan Clower said in a news release. We are serving Iowans out online before the demand for remote learning and online programs accelerated during the past 2 years, and now we are well positioned to continue our role as a go-to resource for Iowa history education. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Jeffrey John Weber, 77, a longtime resident of Iowa City, died on Friday, November 18th, 2022 at Lantern Park Specialty Care in Coralville, Iowa. Jeff, the son of Patricia and David Weber, was born on June 4th, 1945 and grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he attended Washington High School before graduating from Regis High School in 1963. After graduating, Jeff decided to enlist in the Marine Corps, much to the chagrin of his parents. While stationed at Camp Pendleton, he joined with some fellow Marines to form a rock band, The Limits, that played at the E Club. Jeff was eventually deployed to Da Nang, Vietnam during the war, where he found the people and the hot, humid weather much to his liking. As the war progressed, he became disillusioned by the senseless political morass of it all. Jeff was a victim of Parkinson's disease and received generous benefits, both medically and financially, from the Iowa City VA for exposure to Agent Orange in Vietnam. No memorial is planned. However, memorial donations may be directed to any animal welfare organization. Vincent Scolaro, 58, of Cedar Rapids, passed peacefully from this life Wednesday, November 16, 2022, after a long illness. Vincent was born in Cedar Rapids on July 21, 1964, and remained there all his life. He graduated from Kennedy High School in 1972. He worked for Sears at Lindale Mall for years and enjoyed all of his wonderful co-workers. Special thanks to Mercy Hospice for their comfort, respect, and care. Patrick J. White, 81, of Hiawatha, passed away peacefully on Saturday, November 19, 2022, surrounded by his loving family. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Concelebrants will be Reverend Gary Meyer, Reverend Tony Cruz, and Reverend Mark Ressler. Burial, Buffalo Cemetery, Hiawatha. A visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. on Friday at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church and again on Saturday at the church after 9:30 a.m. Tea and Funeral Home is serving the family. Patrick was born in Dyersville to Henry and Florence Ressler White on September 22, 1941. He graduated from St. Paul's High School class of 1959 in Worthington. Pat married Carol Recker on February 9, 1963 at Immaculate Conception Church in Sand Springs. Pat began his married life as a farmer, then studied at DeVry College in Chicago, which led to a career at Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids. Other professions included salesman at Sears, realtor, then retiring from car sales after positions at Gruber Motors, Bruce McGrath, Bob Zimmerman, and Allen Motor Company. He enjoyed serving the city of Hiawatha as a member of the Water Board after retirement. Pat was a founding member of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Church and was a devoted usher. He loved everything nature, including gardening, hiking, birds, and butterflies. He enjoyed playing euchre and solving crosswords. Above all, Pat loved spending time with his family. A memorial fund has been established in Pat's name. Online condolences can be left at teaandfuneralhome.com. James Jim Russell Perry, 70, of Independence, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, November 12, 2022, surrounded by family. Jim was born on September 3, 1952, in Hudson, Iowa, the son of Russell Thomas Perry and Minnie Koenig Perry. Growing up, he lived in Hudson, Iowa, and Jessup, Iowa. Jim graduated from Jessup High School in 1971. He married Gloria Baldwin in 1972, but they later divorced. Jim spent most of his work life at Goss in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jim enjoyed working there and the people he worked with. Jim always had a quick wit and great sense of humor. He enjoyed working with computers and was an avid race fan. Jeffrey Anthony Gerlitz of Cedar Rapids passed away unexpectedly at his home on Wednesday, November 9th, at the age of 61. Born September 5th, 1961, the son of Lawrence and T. Jean Niner Gerlitz, Jeff was the 11th of 12 children. He attended Solon Schools and then later moved to Colorado. Jeff loved Colorado and spent many happy years there running his own cleaning business and selling antiques before returning to the Solon area in 2010. He painted furniture and sold antiques at local farmers markets through his beloved storefront and online business, Goose Lake Creations. An energetic, eclectic artist, Jeff spread joy through color and laughter. He was a friendly face in his neighborhood, frequently giving what little he had to help others. He just loved to see people smile. Jeff loved painting and plants, but mostly people. He was a person of passion and tenacity, never letting an economic slump, a derecho, or any other deterrent keep him from what he loved most. Jeff and his family are being cared for by Caldwell Parish Funeral Home in Urbandale. A service in his honor will be announced at a later date. Robert Rob Norman Wheeler, 64, of Webster, Wisconsin, formerly of Hiawatha, Iowa, passed away on Friday, November 18, 2022, at Regents Hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 29, 2022, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, Iowa. Graveside service with full military honors will begin at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, November 30, 2022, at Shiloh Cemetery in Hiawatha. Rob was born on July 2, 1958 in Barstow, California, the son of James Jim and Edith Edie Cook Wheeler. He was a graduate of Kennedy High School in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Rob served honorably in the United States Army. He worked for Hawkeye Ready Mix as a driver for many years. Rob was an avid outdoorsman and lived to hunt and fish. He will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved him. Memorials in Rob's memory may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Rob at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Greg P. Dunham of Puyallup, Washington, dedicated husband, father of two, and friend of many, passed away October 27, 2022, at the age of 69. Born to Richard and Vivian Durham in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Greg spent his youth in the Hawkeye State. He graduated from Washington High School in Cedar Rapids before attending Utah State University, where he studied history. He got his start in commercial insurance in Salt Lake City, later moving to Los Angeles to work for CNA Insurance. A few years after arriving in L.A., he met the love of his life, Jerry Purcell, whom he married in 1987 and spent the next 35 years building a family with. They welcomed their sons Tom in 1990 and Alan in 1992. In 1994, after being away from the Midwest for nearly 20 years, Greg returned with his family, moving to the Fox Cities of Wisconsin to work for Secura Insurance. There they lived for a decade before moving to Puyallup, Washington in 2004, taking a position as Director of Commercial Underwriting for Mutual of Enumclaw. Through the years, Greg enjoyed taking road trips across the country with his family and friends. Though he never moved back to Iowa, he remained a diehard Hawkeye fan for life, frequently returning to attend games with childhood friends and family at Kinnick Stadium. Greg loved every dog and cat that he met. In his memory, donations can be made in his name to support the Humane Society for Tacoma and Pierce County. A date for a memorial service is yet to be determined. Lawrence George Strobola, 85, died peacefully Sunday, November 20th, 2022, at home surrounded by family. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Monday, November 28th, 2022, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church, with Father Gary Beckman officiating. Visitation will be Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Friends of the Animal Center Foundation, Iowa City. Larry was born November 9, 1937, in Richmond, Iowa, the son of Vino and Villa Schmidt Strobola. He attended Holy Trinity School in Richmond and was a graduate of Colonna High School. On June 10, 1978, Larry married Kathleen Hine. Larry was employed at NCS for over 30 years, retiring in 2000. Larry was a member of St. Wenceslaus Church and the Johnson County Senior Center and its choir. He was a gentle and generous man with a heart of gold and a sense of humor. He loved to share his jokes. Larry rescued chow dogs, played the harmonica, and loved to read and listen to music. That concludes today's Gazette Obituaries. Moving on to today's editorial page, there is a guest column by Amy B. Kretkowski of Iowa City. It's titled, Iowa City Council Not Listening to Quiet Voices. On October 18th, four members of the Iowa City Council, Megan Alter, Laura Burgess, Sean Harmson, and Janice Weiner, approved the Recreation Facilities and Programs Master Plan. despite the absence of details, cost information, and a vision that is consistent with overwhelming public feedback in opposition to the proposed repurposing of the Robert A. Lee Pool and the radical concept redesign of City Park Pool. In approving this plan, the four council members blindly accepted and repeated the city staff's misinformation regarding public feedback on the aquatics portion of the plan. The city staff has consistently dismissed the feedback from community members who actually use and love these pools. Instead, they have emphasized phase one of their community engagement process because that phase allegedly represents the quiet voices in the community who often aren't heard. Who are these quiet voices? According to the plan, phase one involved focus groups, pop-up events, a statistically valid survey, and a community engagement website. See Recreation Facilities and Master Programs Plan at page 24 on an Iowa City website that I won't repeat because it's very complicated. Of the 44 or 47 total participants in the focus groups, at least 14 were and still are city employees, 30% of the total, including City Manager Jeff Fruin, Deputy City Manager Redmond Jones, and Assistant City Attorney Sue Dulek. City employees should not be characterized as among the quiet voices in the community who are not heard. The Phase 1 pop-up events with the most participation were held at the Farmers Market, Soda Fest, and Halloween Carnival, 69, 49, and 36 respondents, respectively. None of these events appear to be designed to reach underserved communities. The Phase 1 statistically valid survey was comprised of 450 random households in the community. Of those respondents, 82% were white, and the largest age group was 65 and older. It does not appear that these are the quiet voices in the community who are not heard. Even worse, the plan's diversity, equity, and inclusion outcomes analysis was entirely based on input from Parks and Rec department staff. The consulting firm asked department staff members to rate their program areas according to DEI factors. In other words, the quiet voices the council members believe they're listening to are actually the voices of the city staff. The city council and staff have weaponized DEI language to serve their desired outcome without actually obtaining input from the quiet voices in the community and without explaining how eliminating one pool and redesigning another serves the goals of diversity, equity, and inclusion. It is regrettable that four city council members approved this plan without understanding the actual source of the Phase 1 feedback. This plan does not represent the needs or desires of quiet voices in this community. This plan represents the desires of city staff. Again, that is a column by Amy B. Kretkowski, who lives in Iowa City. There is one letter to the editor today. It is from Joe Peters of Cedar Rapids and headlined, "School Choice Will Help Iowa Students Catch Up." Iowa's K-12 students need help. Our scholars are still behind in their studies due in large part because of the pandemic. In addition, we have a teacher shortage that hinders our capacity to get our next generation back on track. Iowa public educators are working hard in tough situations, but we need to innovate to address this issue quickly and effectively. I believe this education crisis has a solution, school choice. As a retired public and private school teacher, I am acutely familiar with a wide variety of learning environments. The public school is not always the best option. Smaller teacher-to-student ratios and flexibility with curriculum often seen in private schools help address a plethora of students' needs. Unfortunately, many families across Iowa are not in a financial position to afford tuition, and inflation is making it increasingly difficult. This year, the governor will again propose legislation to advance a crucial K-12 education policy that creates education scholarship accounts. ESAs return tax dollars to parents and are allocated for their children's tuition, should they exercise their freedom to choose a learning environment that best fits their needs. Expanding school choice for Iowa parents will return our students to full academic proficiency. Please ask your lawmakers to support education scholarship accounts. Again, that is a letter to the editor from Joe Peters of Cedar Rapids in today's Gazette. Yield predictions appear rosier as harvest ends. Iowa expected to produce near record 2.51 billion bushels of corn this year by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Average corn yields in Iowa are expected to approach last year's record despite the significant drought that developed throughout the growing season, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Harvest is pretty well complete, and I think people were pleasantly surprised with the corn yields as well as the soybean yields, said Aaron Soigling, an Iowa State University Extension field agronomist who monitors the southwest corner of the state. We did have a pretty full soil moisture profile going into spring. Corn in particular was able to root deep. The USDA predicted this month that corn yields will average 202 bushels per acre, down from 204 last year. The USDA initially reported that last year's yields averaged 205 bushels per acre, but it has revised the estimate. Soybean yields are expected to average 59 bushels per acre, down from 63 last year, which was also a record high. The growing season of 2021 also was drier than normal, but crops were aided by timely rains. The northwest corner of the state bore the brunt of this year's drought, and it shows in the yields. Corn yields in that area are averaging about 170 bushels per acre, said Leah Ten Naple, an extension field agronomist who monitors the area. Yields were very variable for the farmers, she said. Growers in areas that caught timely rains were 200 plus bushels per acre, but some fields had yields of 50 bushels per acre or less, Ten Naple said. We saw big effects of the drought this year, Ten Naple said. Drought conditions were somewhat alleviated earlier this month by widespread heavy rainfall, but the state is in far worse shape heading into winter than it was last year. Peak drought conditions in 2021, which were similar to the current drought overall, happened during the summer and improved considerably by late November. About 13% of the state was suffering from drought a year ago, compared with 73% now. It's unclear what that portends for next year's yields. Statewide, about 38% of subsoil and 48% of topsoil has adequate moisture for crops, the USDA reported Monday. This year, Iowa is projected to produce about 2.51 billion bushels of corn, down from about 2.54 billion last year. That would be the most of any state, with Illinois the runner-up at 2.27 billion bushels. Illinois will lead the nation in soybean production at about 684.8 million bushels, compared with Iowa's 591 million. Iowa has slightly fewer acres of soybeans and lower yields. Airport expects busiest Thanksgiving since 2019. More seats are due to bigger aircraft, director says. By the Gazette. The Eastern Iowa Airport says the facility is on track to record its second busiest year for Thanksgiving travel since 2019. The number of seats in the market are more than 3 years ago for the same holiday period, and flights are expected to be nearly full with Thanksgiving travelers, Airport Director Marty Lentz said in a news release Monday. When comparing available seats in the market for the same Thanksgiving, Monday through Thursday, travel period in 2019 compared to this year, we have 8% more seats this year, Lentz said. In addition, we are seeing much larger aircraft than in 2019. The average number of seats per departure is at 109 per flight. In 2019, that number was 78 seats per flight. That 37% increase is due to airlines' pilot shortage, Lentz said. The airlines have been removing most of the smaller 50-seat regional jets from their fleets and replacing them with larger mainline aircraft. What we are seeing is that our airline partners continue to invest in the CID market, and the region's passengers are responding, he said. It is essential people use CID to not only maintain the air service we have, but to show airlines there are opportunities here to add service. CID refers to the airport's identification letters. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Lentz noted, Allegiant Air added flights to Sarasota, Bradenton, and Frontier Airlines to Orlando International. That gave the airport nonstop flights to 16 destinations, with connections from there on to other locations. Moving on to sports. Iowa football, five Nebraska players to watch. The headline is, Finding Top Talent. Transfer additions, true freshmen stand out, highlight key Huskers to watch, by John Stepp. Friday's Iowa-Nebraska game will feature two football teams that have relied on much different ways of building a roster. Iowa has continued to lean heavily on high school recruiting and trusted its developmental process. Nebraska, in contrast, has turned to the pool of talent in the transfer portal as a way to quickly retool. Here are five Nebraska players to watch as the teams from neighboring states with opposite strategies clash. QB Casey Thompson. After 4 years at Texas, Casey Thompson has stepped into the starting role in his first year at Nebraska. The transfer quarterback has completed 62.7% of his passes while throwing 14 touchdowns and 10 interceptions. Thompson missed time earlier in the season with an arm injury, but returned for the first time in Nebraska's 15-14 loss to Wisconsin last weekend. He was 12-for-20 with two touchdowns. He hit a snag earlier in the season, throwing multiple interceptions in three consecutive games in October. Thompson was a four-star recruit in the 2018 class and had offers from some college football blue bloods, including Ohio State and Oregon, before choosing Texas. He played in 7 games combined in his first 3 years on Texas campus, but earned the starting job early in the 2021 season. He finished the year with 24 touchdowns, 9 interceptions, and a completion percentage of 63.2. Thompson's departure from Austin happened after Texas lured former 5-star recruit Quinn Ewers to the Longhorns via the transfer portal. DB Malcolm Hartzog. Malcolm Hartzog has made a quick impact on the Nebraska secondary. He became the first true freshman at Nebraska to start at cornerback since 2016 after getting the starting nod against Indiana on October 1st. He grabbed his first career interception a week later. Hartzog's 3 interceptions this season are as many as the 2 next-best Nebraska defensive backs combined. Opposing quarterbacks have completed only 46.4% of passes when throwing to the receiver Hartzog is covering, per Pro Football Focus. W.R. Trey Palmer. Trey Palmer transferred from LSU to Nebraska and is putting up the best numbers of his career in 2022. The Kentwood, Louisiana native has 62 receptions for 878 yards and 7 touchdowns, more than his first 3 years in Baton Rouge combined. Palmer showed that he's capable of in Nebraska's 43-37 loss to Purdue earlier this season. The 6'1" wideout had 7 catches for 237 receiving yards and 2 touchdowns on 13 targets. He has not exceeded 50 receiving yards in a game since the October 15th trip to Purdue, though. Edge Garrett Nelson. On a team with a lot of turnover from the transfer portal, Garrett Nelson has been a constant on Nebraska's defense. The last time Nebraska played a game without Nelson starting in it, Nate Stanley was Iowa's quarterback, Circles by Post Malone was the Billboard top song, and the person writing this article was still in college. Nelson has started the last 31 games for the Huskers. The Scottsbluff, Nebraska native has been quite effective in those 31 games. He leads the Huskers with 9 tackles for loss and 5.5 sacks in 2022. He also led the team in those categories in 2021. But just like the rest of the Huskers, Nelson has yet to defeat the Hawkeyes. They are Iowa, Nelson said about this week's game. We obviously have a chip on our shoulder with those guys. Edge O'Shawn Mathis. O'Shawn Mathis was among the higher-profile additions Nebraska had via the transfer portal over the offseason. On3 rated the former TCO defensive lineman as Nebraska's top transfer portal addition of the 2022 offseason. Mathis earned All-Big 12 second-team honors in 2020 and 2021. He started 34 consecutive games for the Horned Frogs before transferring. The only games he did not start at TCU were during his redshirt season. Now, as a Husker, Mathis has 5 tackles for loss and 3.5 sacks in 2022. Both numbers are among the top 3 on the team. Now, Hawkeye men's basketball. Second verse, a lot like the first. Chris Murray off to fast start by Mike Halas. Sequels often are watered-down versions of the originals. That certainly isn't the case with The Murray Show, which again is playing to rave reviews with Iowa men's basketball observers. Last season, of course, Keegan Murray was an All-America forward who averaged 23.5 points for the Hawkeyes. He had averaged 7.2 points for the season before. Keegan left for the NBA's Sacramento Kings last spring. Chris Murray stayed. He's grabbed the torch from his twin brother and is torching opponents so far this season. Murray had a career-high 30 points Monday night in number 25 Iowa's 100-64 win over the Omaha Mavericks, 1-4. That puts his scoring average at 23.8 after he averaged 9.7 last season. He has 59 points in his last 2 games for the 4-0 Hawkeyes. Murray's first shot was blocked. He said he was kind of mad. After that, I don't think I missed a shot till the last one of the first half. Correct. He made 11 straight attempts, including 3 three-pointers for a 25-point first half, which ended up with Iowa up 49-28. That was after the Hawkeyes led 10-9 in the 7th minute. We weren't getting easy baskets early, Iowa forward Patrick McCaffrey said, and then Chris got about 100 of them. From then on, we were kind of rolling. Murray's first half performance eclipsed the 24 first half markers Keegan Murray had against Nebraska last February 13th. He was taken out of the game with 8:40 left, so Chris still has Keegan's career-high 37 to chase. I could have left him in there and he could really have gone for a big number, Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey said, but we're not going to accomplish anything. I'm not going to get him hurt. Living up to his brother's 2021-22 accomplishments would be a burden for many. Murray seems to be shouldering it just fine. It would be easy to just kind of fall into his shadow, I guess, he said, but I know I'm not the same person as him. I'm doing my own thing at Iowa, trying to take this team as far as I can. I think we're two different players, two different people, and I guess it just gives me a little more motivation to kind of do what he did and a little bit more. No, Murray is an island. Iowa made a dozen three-pointers and 26 tries in rolling away. Patrick McCaffrey scored the team's first 7 points of the second half, had 16 points and 3 steals. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.